Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Urban Meyer football era at Ohio State concludes after the team's Rose Bowl matchup with Washington on January 1st. Offensive coordinator Ryan Day will take over as head coach, the university announced this morning. Columbus Dispatch reporter Bill Rabinowitz covers the Buckeyes and has been covering this news today. He joins us by phone. Welcome back, Bill.
How are you, Ann?
I'm pretty good. This was news to you, technically, but you're not surprised.
No, I'm not surprised. And I don't want to say the writing was on the wall, but if you wanted to look at it that way, the writing could have been on the wall. Urban Meyer had been noncommittal about his future. There was a report out last week that said that he was planning to coach one more year. I asked him about that at the Big Ten press conference before the championship game, and he wouldn't comment on it. Shelly Meyer, after the game, said to me and others that she didn't know what his future was. But apparently, you know, he just decided that these headaches from the arachnoid cyst in his head would prevent him from being the kind of coach that he wanted to be. And they had a succession plan in place, obviously, mm-hmm. and Ryan Day is going to be the new coach.
Yeah, there's not a lot of mystery on that score, which is, I suppose, partly because this is planned.
Well, they had to kind of start to think about the future. First of all, when Urban Meyer was suspended this summer, and mm-hmm. it was telling that Ryan Day was the one who was named acting coach and not Greg Schiano or Kevin Wilson, both of whom have head coaching experience. That tells you how highly Ryan Day was thought of inside the building and by Gene Smith. Mm-hmm. And he did well in that stint, which was, you know, a tough thing to do. He had to run training camp and mm-hmm. coach the first three games of the year, including the TCU game, which was a real game. And everyone said that he did a great job. He's a rising star in the profession. He's only 39 years old, and Ohio State clearly wanted to keep him. But this is the first time since 1946 that Ohio State will be hiring a coach without head coaching experience. So obviously, in 2011, Luke Fickell served. He was not technically called an interim coach, but that's essentially what he was after Jim Tressel was forced to resign. But that was around Memorial Day. They didn't have time to do a real coach search. They had to just go with who they had on staff. And so it's the first time since 1946 that Ohio State's hiring a coach without head coaching experience.
So was that sort of maybe like a tryout for Ryan Day then?
Well, it served as one. Certainly if he had not done as well as he did, he wouldn't be getting the job. I mean, mm-hmm. this is one of the top three or four jobs in college football. And for somebody with Ryan Day's lack of head coaching experience to get it just tells you how highly they think of him.
Do they think of him as highly monetarily?
Yeah, they gave him. He started Ohio State making $400,000. He got a bump up to $800,000, which is a nice raise. And then it was bumped up even more to $1 million after the Tennessee Titans wanted to hire him as an offensive coordinator. And there was an SEC school that nobody's come out and said exactly which one it was, but we have an idea. And he turned down that job. So Ryan Day did want to stay in Columbus. I don't know whether there was any kind of promise or hint or whatever. I don't know how you characterize it. Mm-hmm. But clearly Ohio State wanted to keep Ryan Day.
Despite winning that Big Ten championship and a Rose Bowl bid, Ohio State's performance on the field wasn't considered by some as up to its usual standard. Is there a sense that the change was needed anyway?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, Urban Meyer is a legendary coach. I mean, mm-hmm. he has the highest winning percentage of any coach, you know, active today, basically, and three national championships. There's no way that Urban Meyer was pushed out, and the problems with his team have been mainly on defense, and Urban Meyer's expertise is on offense. Obviously, he's responsible for everything, but that doesn't fall directly with him. Urban Meyer was not pushed out. I think Urban Meyer realized that these headaches that he was having were preventing him from being the kind of hard-driving, highly intense coach that he is, and person he is. He can't change who he is. That's the way he is. And I know that it was a very difficult thing this year for him to deal with, these headaches. I mean, you could see it. He was constantly rubbing his temples, and you know, nobody knows how badly somebody is in pain mm-hmm. unless you're that person. And Urban Meyer is a pretty tough guy, and he couldn't hide it. So whether that was 80% of the factor or whether it was the residual, I don't know if resentment is the word, but, you know, he was clearly not happy to be suspended and mm-hmm. and has feelings about that. But I think it was more of a health issue, honestly.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Columbus Dispatch sports reporter Bill Rabinowitz. He covers the Buckeyes, and that's what we're doing right now. The news this morning that Urban Meyer will end his run with the Buckeyes on January 1st at the conclusion of the Rose Bowl. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. His last contract extension signed in April left the possibility for Urban Meyer to take on an administrative role at the university. Anything about that?
No, I don't really know anything about that. I've been trying to write a Ryan Day story that just posted at dispatch.com a few minutes ago, and I've done what I can do in terms of reporting, but I don't know anything about that.
And do you think, I mean, how old is Urban Meyer? He's still relatively young.
Well, thank you. We're the same age. He's 54.
Right, exactly. I think that's practically, that's like my little brother. His career doesn't necessarily have to be over. He just has to resolve these issues with this cyst in his brain, or is that unresolvable?
I think he's done as a coach. I think Ohio State was his ultimate dream job.
Okay.
And to coach anywhere else would be, I just don't think that that's going to happen. I mean, people have mentioned him to coach in the NFL. He believes, and Shelley Meyer certainly believes, that he's a college coach, not an NFL coach. Hmm. Could that itch come back at some point? Maybe. It certainly did after he stepped down at Florida, and mm-hmm. It was about 2 weeks later that he told Shelley, I can't do this, meaning not coach. So it's in his blood, but I've never thought of him, and he doesn't either, as a Joe Paterno, a guy who hangs on too long. He's too intense, and honestly, he loves Ohio State too much to kind of be a caretaker coach. I just don't think he, after coaching Ohio State, that he would want to coach anywhere else. Now, again, that could change. You never know with coaches. They are different.
Tell us a little bit about Ryan Day now and his work with offense. Dwayne Haskins, Ohio's starting quarterback, has spoken very highly of him. What do we want to know about his background?
Yeah, he's 39 years old. He's from New Hampshire. He played for Chip Kelly at New Hampshire. Chip Kelly's the very innovative coach who really kind of was the godfather of the quick offense, the get up and snap the ball as fast as you can offense. He has coached in the NFL for a couple of years. He came to Ohio State, and people kind of thought that he would take a backseat a little bit to Kevin Wilson, because Kevin Wilson is older, more experienced, had been a head coach at Indiana. But it was pretty clear early on that Ryan Day was a rising star, and it was pretty clear this year that Ryan Day had more of the offense than Kevin Wilson did. He's everyone that I've ever talked to about him, and obviously my interaction with him, he's a solid guy, a very, he's a rising star in the profession, and Ohio mm-hmm. State clearly wanted to keep him.
You know, for a lot of us, the coaches are kind of recessive. They're sort of in the background. You cover them. What makes, when do you start to see, and what are the signals that someone like Ryan Day is a rising star?
Well, some of it is how their players perform. And yeah. Last year, JT Barrett broke a ton of records, and this year with a completely different type of quarterback, Dwayne Haskins is a Heisman Trophy finalist. And so, some of that, most of that is the player. I mean, the player has to get on the field and perform, but the coach has to put the player in positions to succeed, and Ryan Day clearly has done that. And, everyone that I've talked to about Ryan Day has been complimentary. He doesn't seem to be a big ego guy. There's going to be a learning curve. This is kind of unprecedented. It's been such a long time since anything like this happened, and I'm sure there'll be some bumps along the way. It's hard to replace a legend, and Urban Meyer as a coach is a legend. And I think a lot of this was done because they wanted to maintain continuity in the program. Urban Meyer's key people, including strength coach Mickey Marotti, apparently are going to stay.
Okay.
Mark Pantone, who's just a master with recruiting, same thing. So I think continuity was a huge factor in this. Then rather than bringing in a new coach, he's going to bring in his new staff. And the change now, starting last year, is that recruiting, it used to be the signing day, the only signing day was in early February. Now there's one that's really the big one in December, in a couple weeks, 2-3 weeks. And to disrupt the staff and go on a coaching search while you're trying to maintain and build a recruiting class, that's a bad timing. And so now Ohio State can say to their recruits, things are going to remain as close to the same as possible. And that's, I think, a huge, huge factor in all this.
And I get that, but there's also that issue of bringing in your own team, bringing in your own, group of leaders.
Right, but I also would say, I'm guessing, I don't want to put words in Ryan Day's mouth, but these probably are his people.
Gotcha.
Mark Pantone and Mickey Marotti, he knows them, he's worked with them. These are his people now, and they've got a well-oiled machine at Ohio State, and basically with everything. And to disrupt that, I think, was something that they did not want to do.
What about, I know you've gotten a lot of phone calls this morning because of what you happen to be doing, which is covering, the Ohio State Buckeyes, but what are people saying about this?
I don't know.
You're no good to me, Bill.
Bubble.
Okay.
I would imagine people are, I'm guessing, that people are not shocked.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear that Meyer was having health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty clear that Ohio State thought very highly of Ryan Day, so there might be some surprise, especially at the timing a little bit, but not. I don't think there's people that are going to be like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Right. And with the national championship, 3 Big Ten titles, those are the overt things. What kind of legacy does Urban Meyer leave with Columbus?
Yeah, it is that. But I would also say this, and I would think Urban Meyer would tell you that the thing he is at least as proud of is the stuff with player development off the field, the fact that they really are this real-life Wednesday program they have to try to get their players transitioning already to a post-football life. And Urban Meyer, I think, wants that as a big part of his legacy, that he's not just a football coach, that he has prepared these players, and Ohio State has prepared these players to go on from football, that they have to have resumes in order, that they have to know how to dress professionally, they know how to have a bank account. I mean, all these things, adulting. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to prepare the players for that. And I think that is something that is I don't say it was new at Ohio State, but certainly taken it to a much different level than he ever did at Florida, for example. Mm. So I think that's what I would guess Urban Meyer would say, that as much as the victories, he wants to be part of his legacy. Now, Urban Meyer is maybe the most competitive person I've ever met. I can't even describe it. I do a video review of games in the Michigan game when Terry McLaurin plowed a Michigan player for a first down, and Urban Meyer on the sideline gives, two punches. He's like he's Muhammad Ali.
Mm-hmm.
And that tweet, the little 9-second thing, got like 200,000 hits. And it's like, that resonated. That's who Urban Meyer is. People know that's who Urban Meyer is.
But now he counts among his strengths as a coach the ability to prepare them for life after football.
Yeah, I that is, again, I don't want to say it's new. I think he cared about that at Florida, but he didn't have a system in place, a program in place to do that, and now he does at Ohio State. So he can say that, yes, a lot of these guys, obviously, they come, every one of these guys comes to Ohio State thinking they're going to go to the NFL.
Mm-hmm.
Well, most of them don't. And he knows that just having a degree these days is not enough, that you have to actually have some kind of something more to prepare them for the real world. And I think that the Real Life Wednesdays program and the other stuff that they've done does do that.
And you think this is stuff that Ryan Day is going to sustain through his career there?
I would be very surprised if that doesn't stay the same, because honestly, it's a great recruiting tool. I mean, if you want to look at it cynically, which, I don't think it's the right way to do it, but if you did, you could say, well, that's a big selling point to parents of kids, that they can say, look, we are preparing your son for life after football, too.
Bill Rabinowitz, thanks for carving out some time for us today. I really appreciate it.
Happy to do it, Ann. Thank you.
That's Bill Rabinowitz, Columbus Dispatch sports writer, covering the Urban Meyer, the announcement today that Urban Meyer will resign after the Rose Bowl on January 1st as Ohio State's head football coach. Coming up, we're going to get to the Ohio Constitution and efforts to change the ease with which it can be amended at the ballot box. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The only statewide ballot question on the November ballot was a proposed constitutional amendment that failed to muster the needed simple majority of votes. But it did catch the attention of some state lawmakers who want to make it tougher to amend the Constitution by ballot. It's the latest blip in a long line for the 215-year-old Ohio Constitution, the original of which went on display in the Ohio State House last month. Coming up, we're going to hear about the document's history and the new exhibit. Don McTighe has worked in election law for 35 years. He's a former chief elections counsel to the Ohio Secretary of State and former counsel to the Ohio Elections Commission. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Don.
Thank you, Ann. Glad to be here.
State Representative Sarah LaTourette, a Republican from Geauga County, is a primary co-sponsor of an Ohio House resolution that would require proposed constitutional amendments win 60% rather than the current 50% of the statewide vote, among other things. She joins us now as well. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Representative LaTourette, why now?
Well, you probably heard both the Speaker and the Senate President talking a lot about this after one of the most recent ballot initiatives,
issue one.
Right. And so they both became very passionate about the fact that they believed, I think a lot of people believe, that there are these outside groups that are spending a lot of money to buy their way into our Constitution. And I think we've seen that a lot over the last several years. And so there became a real desire to try to do something about that, making sure that individuals here in the state of Ohio, that citizens still have a voice and are a part of the process, but making sure that these outside groups don't continue to try to buy their way in.
The outside groups tend to fail, though. You don't have confidence in Ohio voters to know when it's a good idea and not or not?
Well, I can't say I don't have confidence in Ohio voters. I absolutely do. But I think the issue becomes they have a lot of money to spend. And I think that when you spend that significant amount of money, any issue can sound like a good issue if you put enough bells and whistles on it on TV.
But couldn't Ohio voters now, under these restrained circumstances, have a great issue to put on the ballot? A really good point. But without a large amount of money, how to overcome getting that magic 60% of affirmative votes and that kind of a thing? I mean, isn't it making it tougher for everyday Ohioans to do anything?
I would say this resolution is absolutely making it harder to amend the Constitution, but that's why you see the entire second portion of the resolution where we're trying to make it easier as far as amending statute goes.
Don McTighe, what about the change to the constitutional amendment process?
I'd say, first of all, that I think this issue about out-of-state money or large amounts of money is kind of a red herring. That assumes that voters, aren't smart enough to cut through the ads, make up their own mind, based on reading the text or based on just, where they're coming from. In terms of Joint Resolution 19, I actually think that it makes some, suggestions for proposed changes that would be good. It's important to understand what the point of discussion has been hasn't really been about about outside money or large amounts of money. It's about whether or not it's appropriate to put something into the Constitution as opposed to whether it's more appropriate in the form of a statute. And Ohio law allows citizens to do both. It gives them that power. It's a reserved power to citizens to initiate either constitutional amendments or laws. So what Joint Resolution 19 does is it tries to address that issue in two ways. Number one, by making it easier to propose state laws. And let me say this: I've been working about 35 years in election law, but in private practice, I've worked with probably 2 to 3 dozen statewide ballot issues. And the choice, when I have to explain to clients what the options are between a constitutional amendment or proposed law, it really comes down to two factors. One is General Assembly can change a law right after you pass it. It's not a real issue, it's a bit of an issue. It's not an overwhelming issue, because the fact of the matter is General Assembly in the past has not really done that, because it would be politically difficult after the voters have approved something. But the bigger issue has always been that it takes much more time to get a proposed state law on the ballot than it does a constitutional amendment. It's more expensive to do a constitutional amendment, but it takes almost twice as long, and you might have to wait 2 years before you can actually be on the ballot on a proposed state law. So what Joint Resolution 19 does is it actually remedies, it makes it easier for people to go with the state statute because it cuts the time period down where you can get on the ballot the same year that you're, you know, filing your petitions. It actually reduces the signature requirement overall, making it somewhat less expensive. It does have a one-year hiatus where the General Assembly cannot change that. That's a little different than what was recommended by the Constitutional Revision Commission.
3 to 6 or 3 to 9 years?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I thought it was like 5, but but it required a supermajority of the legislature to make changes. So I think some tinkering could be done with that particular provision.
Mm-hmm.
But my main point on this is that actually these changes actually resolve the problem that has existed about why my clients go towards constitutional amendments. This will now push them towards doing
legislative initiative. Yeah.
Right. And the problem is we don't need to make it harder to do constitutional amendments. What we need to do is make it easier just to do state statutes. Because if you make it harder to do constitutional amendments, you're asking people to give up power to that they have reserved to themselves. When they do need to do it, for example, if they need to pass a constitutional amendment, because sometimes you do have to do constitutional amendments to protect rights or to overcome roadblocks that currently exist in the Constitution, they will have given up that power unless they can get 60%.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. You just heard from election law expert Don McTighe, lawyer in practice for many years in Ohio and worked for the state of Ohio for many years as well. Also with us, State Representative La Tourette. She's a Republican state representative from Geauga County, and she is one of the primary co-sponsors of House Joint Resolution 19, which would affect and change how you can get proposed constitutional amendments on the Ohio ballot, and also initiated proposed statutes, that is changing state law instead of the Constitution. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So Representative La Tourette, what about what Don McTighe said as far as why didn't you just make it easier to do the one thing instead of making it harder to do the other thing?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate his comments revolving around this statutory initiative process, because I believe that that's been really left out of the conversation. A lot of the opponents to the resolution that we're carrying
are focused on the constitutional piece.
Absolutely. Yeah. And entirely leaving out the fact that we are trying to make it easier for citizens to revise statute. Ohio is one of only 18 states that even allows citizen-initiated constitutional amendments. And so, I mean, we are definitely in the minority. So I don't believe that making it a little bit more difficult to amend our founding document, to amend the Constitution here of the state of Ohio, is uncalled for. And so what I believe this resolution does is strikes a very careful balance. It tries to make sure that we are protecting our founding document and we are steering citizens towards the statutory process, because I believe that's where they can affect change the most.
The initiated constitutional amendment, it's a 116-year-old right. One editorial page in Ohio at least has cautioned that any change should be bipartisan and deliberate. What do you think? Is it bipartisan yet?
I do have a Democrat joint sponsor, but I believe at this point he's probably the only one joining me supporting this, which is unfortunate because, again, I think that the speaker was very deliberate in helping me craft this resolution by including the entire second portion. So I would understand the criticism if we were only trying to make it more difficult to amend the Constitution. But I think by balancing it out and really pointing citizens towards amending statute really is the right way to go. And I wish that more people would pay attention to that.
Why the prohibiting a statute proposed by initiative petition and approved by the voters, it prohibits the General Assembly from amending it, repealing it, or suspending it for just 1 year. Why not a longer period of time as recommended by various bodies?
Well, and I can't say we won't end up with a longer period of time. I think that this was a starting point. We had some individuals that were a little leery of including that in the first place. I think Don was absolutely right. Once something finds its way into statute through a citizen process like this, I don't think you're going to see the General Assembly coming back and trying to change it. I just don't think that we're in the business of trying to change the will of the people in that manner. And so I don't believe it would be an issue anyway. So I think the 1 year was a starting point. We've already had conversations about maybe increasing that to 2 years or even looking beyond that. But I think the 1 year was simply a starting point to get the conversation going.
Lynn in Mount Sterling, you're on the air. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, good morning.
Go ahead.
Well, I think citizens should actually be able to bring in constitutional changes and amendments, but I do disagree with that. Voters are smart enough not to get wielded in by the advertisement that goes on with this.
I think most people vote
their opinions.
Okay, that's it. Yeah, in your opinion, voters aren't smart enough to be persuaded, but it happens every day in every election anyway,
yeah,
right?
It does.
Yeah.
And I find that very disappointing that people don't take, I mean, we're really lucky we get to vote on so many things and issues in our country, and not to educate yourself and try to put your opinions aside instead of looking at facts. Yeah. It's really disheartening to me.
Lynn, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Don McTighe, I mean, so you're thinking about HJR, House Joint Resolution 19, as something that could be worked on and tweaked, or does the effort to make the initiated constitutional amendment process more difficult a deal breaker for you? What?
Well, of course, I don't get to vote.
I know.
in the legislature anyways, but I really am opposed to raising it to 60%. I think, first of all, that's kind of like a solution to a problem that doesn't exist because of the fact that these almost never pass. They never get to 50%. Okay? So what are we accomplishing? All we're really accomplishing is putting something in there that's going to make it harder to pass something, say when it gets 51, 55%, it's not going to pass. The Constitutional Revision Commission had recommended raising it to 55%. I think that's better than 60. The other thing I would point out is the General Assembly, under another part of the Constitution, can place constitutional amendments on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't require the 60%, at least not in this Joint Resolution 19. So obviously, you know, it should be the same whichever way it gets put on the ballot. But in the end, I really think that what we're talking about here is something that's, I don't think you need to make it harder to do constitutional amendments in order to push people in the other direction. And I think that's it'll become the rule of unintended consequences. Mm-hmm.
Well, all right. So, Representative LaTourette, why not impose the same 60% on lawmakers that, in that process?
So Don is absolutely correct. We do not change that in this resolution. Mm-hmm. That still would be a 50% percent of the vote by the people to amend the Constitution that way. However, in order for a constitutional amendment that's initiated by the General Assembly to even get to the ballot, it does take 3/5 vote of both chambers. So in essence, 60% of the General Assembly has to agree that it's something that should move forward. So we have the 60% threshold at that level, and we didn't carry it over to the vote. I don't know that we're necessarily opposed to it.
Uh-huh.
Again, in a lot of my conversations, I've tried to remind people that we're just trying to start the conversation here. I think there are a lot of ideas about how we most effectively get at the issue at hand. And again, the document you see in front of you, the joint resolution as drafted, is just a place to start. But I believe that, at least I felt like, since the General Assembly has that 60% threshold within our chamber itself, I didn't know that we needed to carry that over.
That created a threshold that doesn't necessarily exist for voters out there gathering signatures.
Correct.
But the Constitutional Revision Commission recommended 55%. What's the magic of 60? Taking the point, Don's good point that these things usually never win, and they usually come in well below 50%.
Again, I think that was modeled after the 3/5 in both chambers. So when we were looking at what should we increase it to, I think that there was a strong desire to increase it. And I agree that a lot of these initiatives don't pass. But I think that you look at issue one, and it sounded on its face like a really good issue. I mean, it had a lot of great elements to it. But when you look at some of these constitutional amendments and how poorly written they are and the unintended consequences they will have if they end up in our Constitution, I think that we owe it to the citizens of Ohio to increase that threshold.
You said it looked like a really good issue, but lawmakers have jumped on this issue of changing how people can get things on the ballot, not so much looking at sentencing reform.
I would disagree. We've done some stuff in the previous budget, but I do agree that we absolutely should be focused more on that in the state of Ohio. And I think you've heard a real commitment from both the Speaker and the Senate President and the incoming administration to do just that.
Dominic Tighe, what are your, I mean, it sounds like, you know, Representative La Tourette says this is a starting point. You agree it's a good starting point? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. It is a good starting point. And, I think there are, there has to be some opportunity for, I think, I don't know if it's going to have hearings. I haven't really looked yet to see if there's going to be any committee hearings scheduled or how it's going to make its way, to the floor. But I think that there needs to be some opportunity, at least for give and take. And, I'll be happy to offer, to whoever wants to listen. And I'm sure Representative La Tourette, is one of those people that.
Well, what is the process, Representative La Tourette? What do you expect how this to go, how this will go?
Well, first of all, Don, we'd love to have you come in and testify. I think that'd be great. We do have several hearings scheduled this week. I believe there are three hearings in the Government Accountability and Oversight Committee today, tomorrow, and Thursday,
That's
possibly.
Fast.
It is, but we're short on time. And so I don't know that signals that this will get done, this General Assembly. I think we all recognize that this is a very big lift and a very serious conversation, and rushing it through isn't necessarily the way to go. But the Speaker did feel very strongly that we get the conversation started, and if we can reach some kind of consensus, and if there is a path to get it done, we need to make sure we're doing everything we can to make sure that that happens. So you're going to see a lot of conversations about it. I don't know if it will make it to the calendar for a floor vote or not, but there's going to be a lot of committee discussion this week.
All right. Well, Representative Sarah La Tourette, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you very much.
And Don McTighe, thanks to you as well.
And thank you. And thank you, Representative La Tourette.
State Representative Sarah La Tourette, Republican from Geauga County. She's primary co-sponsor of an Ohio House resolution that would change how we get constitutional amendments on the statewide ballot and also how we get initiated proposed statute changes on the statewide ballot. And Don McTighe's worked in election law for 35 years, former chief elections counsel to the Ohio Secretary of State, and former counsel to the Ohio Elections Commission. We will continue our conversation, but look back in history a little bit. With the Ohio Constitution, which is now on permanent display at the Ohio State House. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The state constitution has received a fair amount of attention this year. While voters rejected a proposed constitutional amendment that would have changed sentencing standards in Ohio on Election Day, historians were putting the finishing touches on a new statehouse exhibit of the original two constitutional documents. Yes, there's two. Joining us is the president of the Ohio Telecom Association and longtime chairman of the Capitol Square Foundation, Charlie Moses. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And also Director of Museum and Library Services at the Ohio History Connection, Megan Wood. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
So, Megan, you took charge of this exhibit and created it?
Well, our role was helping to bring the document to the State House and working with the folks at the State House Museum, CSRAB, and RODO. CSRAB really took the lead in creating the exhibit, but we were a part of helping to put it together and also really working on the stewardship of the document.
That's a Capitol Square Review and Advisory Board. or commission?
Board.
Board, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Why is the Ohio Constitutional special? Why should we be able to see it? What difference does it make?
Well, we've got two constitutions, yeah, which is also special, that the first one was written in a way where we could revise it, which we did less than 50 years later. And I think to get to see the real thing up close and personal, I always would say my job is awesome because I was one of three people that could open the safe to see the constitutions, mm-hmm, and to see the look on people's faces when they saw the real thing. So now my job is even more awesome because we got to help everybody have that same experience.
Charlie Moses, why did this become a priority?
Well, the whole mission of the Capitol Square Foundation is to increase public awareness of what happens in the State House and why it's important to you. We want to enrich the experience to everyone who comes. And there's nothing better that we could do than bringing the Constitution, the real thing, to the State House. So students and of any age can come, view it, understand it, get their tie to history, because we're all Ohioans and we all have a link to these documents.
How are they being protected?
There's a lot of different safe measures around light and around the temperature and humidity. Working closely with Roto Studio, the casework protects it, also security and fire measures. And then we are going to rotate out pages. So you're only seeing two at a time.
Right.
The document has to rest from light after a while. And we have all these great measures in place to calculate how much light is on the document before we rotate it so that it doesn't fade or hurt the paper.
Almost as much science as history.
Yeah.
Right. And tell us more about the exhibit itself. What's it like? It's not just pieces of the physical Constitution.
That's correct. Going all the way back to the renovation, we've been talking about this for about 30 years,
right,
literally. We built the museum in the State House 10 years ago, and we talked about it then. It was too expensive. The building wasn't secure. We just were unable to bring it home. And this, the stars lined up that we could finally do it this time. The key to it is not just seeing the document. It's understanding what it's about, who wrote it, when it was written, Ohio's history at the time. Why did it change 50 years later? What is it today? There's interactive exhibits that go all around both the 1802 and 1851 versions that lets the visitor understand its meaning and why they should pay attention to it.
And why should they?
Well, it's the founding document. It governs all that we do. Much of this we take for granted and don't think about enough. And our goal is to get people to understand their government better. The further government away is from the people, the worse we are off, frankly. And the making it something that folks can identify to is critically important to Ohio's future.
I haven't seen the exhibit, and I apologize for that. I'm sorry I haven't yet. But, you know, one of the things you always hear the candidates say and say is, I balance the budget, I balance the budget, I balance the budget. And, you know, State House reporters, and you know, Charlie, that they have to balance the budget.
They do.
In the state constitution.
That's right.
What are some other things in the Constitution that people might not be aware of that govern our lives as much?
Well, a lot of it, you should probably have some constitutional experts on here, but a lot of it mirrors the federal constitution. It ratifies what's in the U.S. Constitution. That's a big piece of it. It has really set the course for Ohio's history. The first constitution contemplated a weak governor, a weak executive, with a very strong legislative presence. The 1851 version changed that. And if you think about Ohio's history, it sort of lines up with the Revolutionary War, the Northwest Ordinance, on to the Civil War. The document was written in 1851. The State House was being constructed then, you're right before the Civil War, which is and established a much stronger executive. And the current Constitution is really based off of the 1851 version. We've just been adding to it. And there have been reforms ever since, and that continue to be, as you said earlier on your show.
Right. How big is the Constitution, Megan Wood?
So the 1802 version is a little smaller, and it's written on both sides
is
of the paper.
8.5 by 11?
Yeah, it's about okay, regular letter okay size. You might say that you could run it through your printer.
Okay.
Not a good idea,
not
though.
Not a good idea, right.
And so it's double-sided. It's around 30 pages, but 16 folios because on both sides. So I think that speaks to a practicality, but also the idea that it could be revised, that it might not have been the end-all document. And then the 1851 Constitution is larger, maybe more like legal ledger size, one-sided, and there's around 30 pages of that as well. So we have two of those on display at a time that'll be rotated.
Okay. Charlie?
Well, one other thing I want to say, I think it's important for folks to see, because it sort of brings all of us together. At our opening last week, we had not only the governor and the speaker and the Senate president and all the dignitaries, we had former members coming back, former governors there of both parties. This is really a nonpartisan thing. Understanding Ohio's history and our connection to it is really important. And the history connection took care of these documents for decades. And now they're out there for everyone to see. There is a natural curiosity to take a look at something that's that old, that if you think about 1802, the people that went to Chillicothe and spent a month writing this document, you know, how that happened, how that came together, who those people were, and what they brought to the table. Same thing in 1851 and how we've changed it since then. It has a unifying effect in really studying something that belongs to all of us.
Well, what do we know, Megan Wood? I mean, who did write the document back then?
So the convention convened in Chillicothe. There was the faction of the Federalist and the Republican Democrats who were, you know, trying to deal with Arthur Sinclair and trying to bring statehood about pretty quickly. So it was a collection of people. I don't think we know exactly who did the handwriting of the document.
Because it is handwritten, the first one?
It is. Both of them are.
Both of
them are handwritten. And these are the official Secretary of State versions, you know, the official constitutions for the state. And we do know that Thomas Worthington got on his horse in December and rode to Washington so that Thomas Jefferson could sign the document. So I think there's a great drama there that maybe could be a new Hamilton musical about the about Ohio statehood. I keep putting it out there. Maybe it'll happen. So we don't know the particulars of the, you know, the actual writers, but we do know who was there at the convention, what they were working on, how they were trying to quickly bring the first state to the Northwest Territory.
One of my favorite books is Miracle in Philadelphia, which is the writing of the U.S. Constitution. Is there a real story behind the Ohio Constitution?
I think the fight between how much power would be with the governor and what kind of state Ohio is going to be, there was a lot of drama and back and forth and sort of the majority trying to quickly get the document signed, which I think speaks to also why 1851 rolls around and there's a need to expand and to think about, you know, a state that had, you know, tens of thousands of people to a state that had millions of people just very in a very short period of time.
I'm trying to get a fix on how much of the museum, and that's the Below Ground Museum in the Ohio State House, a beautiful place, how much is devoted to this?
Well, it's the center of the museum
now.
It's
in the
so
center.
We
okay.
still have in the museum How a Bill Becomes a Law, the three branches of government. We actually...
the media section?
We don't have that yet. And we need to work on that
right.
part of it. But
gotcha.
it's an important exhibit because it does give the visitor a sense of what happens in the state house, why it's important, all things legislative, executive, and judiciary. But the centerpiece now is the Constitution. There's no question. It's the first thing you see when you go in. It's the most compelling. It's to us. It's the founding document in the foundation of the most important building in the state.
And we believe there's no other state capital that is hosting its constitution on permanent display. So it's a real gift, I think, to the people of Ohio. You know, our mission is about sparking discovery of Ohio's stories. And, you know, for us to be a part of this and to see that gift given back to Ohioans is a real joy.
Why do you think that Ohio would be the only such state? Why do you think there isn't more interest in state constitutions such as they are?
It's a good question. We were the first state to put an active interactive museum in the actual state house. Many of them have them close by at their history centers or whatever. I'm not really sure why. I think there is a renewal, though, in looking at these documents because they do control the destiny of all those in that particular state. And I think we may be onto something. My guess is in a couple of years, you'll see many more state capitals do what we're doing.
Is the Ohio History Connection making an issue of this? Are you writing about it? Are you publishing about it?
We'll be talking about it more and more, and I bet that very soon our colleagues at other state historical organizations will be asking us how we did it. They'll be going to the State House, and because it's not easy to put a document on display like this, which I think is part of the reason. But we're paving the way. You know, our U.S. Constitution isn't in the Capitol.
Right.
So we're really in a unique position.
How much did it cost to get the right technology in place to make this possible?
Well, the exhibit itself cost about $850,000, and it's a public-private match.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we thank the governor and the legislature for being supportive. And again, this goes back to the whole renovation. It's been public and private dollars.
Right.
The museum was the same way. So I think we'll probably have some costs that go beyond the $850,000. But some of the research that was already done, we've been able to take advantage of. I mean,
such as?
Well, Roto's, they're a museum design firm.
Okay.
So they do this for a living. And the History Connection does this for a living. So we're able to take advantage of both of those organizations, put those together. And now the CSRAB, as we mentioned, the Capitol Square Review and Advisory Board, will have to take care of this document now that it's there. So it was really a three-way approach to this, private dollars, public dollars, and the expertise of the History Connection and our design firm, Roto, out of Dublin, Ohio.
When you rotate the pages, who does that and what's the process?
So there are three of us at the Ohio History Connection and three staff at the State House Museum that have the ability to open the case. And so we'll work together on opening the casework carefully.
Will
and
you
then
like be elbowing each other out of the way to get to see who turns the key?
We'll be able to take turns. We have lots of opportunity for rotation. About every 3 months, there'll be a new page coming up on display. And We are using the casework both as a vault for the documents and also the display. So, you know, we'll do it when we're not open and we'll have Highway Patrol there helping us. There won't be any lemon juice on the documents to find secret treasure maps. So we'll be able to. Roto made it pretty easy for us.
How, you know, in the first Constitution, you said that they wrote on both sides of the page. How hard is it? I mean, is there a way that they display it so that it's not, you can actually read it?
The handwriting is a little difficult to read. So we have it only so you can see one side right now.
Yeah.
So we're going to work through that a little bit as we rotate through the pages. We're going to be working ongoing with the paper conservator to make sure, you know, we knew the documents were stable. We're going to make sure they continue to be stable.
What kind of paper are they on?
It's a vellum. The 1851 has more of a cotton content to it. So, you know, we think about how our newspapers fade really quickly now because the cotton content is really low. But the 1851 is on a more stable paper than the earlier vellum of the 1802.
And the ink?
The ink is, you know, I'm not sure exactly what it's composed of, but it's not fading yet. And the paper conservators tell us that once ink starts to fade, it'll fade even in the dark. So our job's working.
It's a process, though.
Yeah. Working with the State House Museum together is to make sure that that doesn't happen.
How long has the Constitution been under kind of lock and key and been preservation mode?
We've had it in a safe since 1978 at the Ohio History Center. And before that, the Secretary of State's office kept it tucked away.
Uh-huh.
So it really has never been on ongoing public display until this point.
And the lighting and everything is special is because of these issues with the content of the paper and the ink.
Yeah, it's LED lights. And when you walk up to the case, you have the magic of touching a button to bring the lighting up. And our casework is telling us how often those lights are turned on and how much light the document has been exposed to.
Well, Megan Wood, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Megan Wood is Director of Museum and Library Services at the Ohio History Connection. Charlie Moses, President of the Ohio Telecom Association and a longtime chairman of the Capitol Square Review and Advisory
Foundation.
Capitol Square Foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right. Thank you as well.
You bet. Thank you.
And thanks everybody else for listening. This is It for All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.